welcome to another episode of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. It's Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. A progressive and populist insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining show on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people and not just the elite few. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters from his mid-Michigan attic, it's time for the award-winning Pat Johnston. It's all yours, Pat.
Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and Florida Mike Rogers, the hand-picked dear leader selection to be the Michigan MAGA Republican nominee for the state's open Senate seat, is trying to say that he wasn't a lobbyist or a whore for lobbyists. Well, I mean, he's trying to deny that he didn't work on behalf of Big Pharma, and he's attacking the Democratic frontrunner, the working class progressive Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed, and even threatened to sue Dr. Abdul with a cease and desist order, crying that he's never worked as a Big Pharma lobbyist. Now, he did work on behalf of Big Pharma in Congress, but don't you dare call him a Big Pharma lobbyist. Florida Mike Rogers, and again, we call him Florida Mike because he ran out of the state of Michigan to make more money in Florida being a lobbyist. Florida Mike then returned to Michigan in 2023 so that way he could run for Debbie Stabenow's open Senate seat, only to lose just barely against the centrist establishment Democratic champion, Alyssa Slotkin. I mean, she would have won in blowout fashion, or she should have, but she presented little vision or little fight in her campaign, and she almost allowed a loser and swamp creature like Florida Mike Rogers to win that seat. But Florida Mike Rogers still cannot stay out of Florida. The Detroit Metro Times' Steve Neveling reported last winter how Florida Mike ran his campaign for a couple of days from Cape Coral, Florida, during November of last year. Florida Mike says, of course, that he was visiting family for Thanksgiving in Florida, so naturally he would campaign for a Michigan Senate seat in Florida. Well, look, I'll tell you what, spend Thanksgiving Day there with your family, Mike, that's fine, but then you should just come right back up here on Black Friday and campaign for the state that you supposedly love. Come on now, Mike. But he didn't, and then he said on some right-wing Breitbart show earlier this year that he'd rather be on a Florida beach than in the cold Michigan winter. Look, is that last part the worst part about Florida Mike Rogers? No, I think there are many Michiganders who think that in January. But like with Democratic Senate candidate State Senator Mallory McMorrow, whose old tweets where she complained about Michigan, including the weather, well, those hurt her a bit. Well, then so too with Florida Mike Rogers having always to travel to Florida and then longing to be in its weather. By the way, being in Florida right now on June 25th of 2026, hey, you can have it. You can have all the humidity, all of the sweat, all of the bugs, all of the cranky old people, you can have it. Now, back to this whole lobbyist thing with Florida Mike Rogers. Florida Mike has received, according to Open Secrets, a total of over $670,000 from Big Pharma lobbyists during his political career. Not a lobbyist, but always working on behalf of Big Pharma. And when Florida Mike was in Congress some 20 years ago, the Michigan Independent reports that back in 2003, Rogers voted against a bill that would have allowed reimportation of drugs from foreign countries. In a Lansing State Journal op-ed the following month, Rogers and then State Representative Dave Camp from Michigan, you remember that guy, repeated industry talking points warning, quote, unmonitored reimported prescription drugs can and have killed American citizens, unquote. Not a pharma lobbyist, but always doing exactly what the Big Pharma industry is telling him to do. By the way, let's not forget that a few months ago, a spokesperson for Florida Mike Rogers lied by saying that Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed is Egyptian-born and not a naturalized citizen. Of course, in fact, he is, and apparently loves spending more of his time, more of his life, in the state of Michigan, you know, the state that he wants to represent in the Senate, than Florida Mike Rogers has ever wanted to stay here. And Florida Mike owns it. He owns it that he loves Florida more than Michigan. Still don't get why he wants to be here. Now, there was this fantastic story by Rob French in Bridge, Michigan back in 2024 detailing how, as a congressman, Florida Mike Rogers advocated to push opiates on more and more Americans suffering with pain. As the story notes, Rogers' home state wasn't spared, with 27,000 people dying from opiates since 2000, the equivalent of the city of Hamtramck becoming a cemetery. Since 2021, one Michigander has died every 4 hours from an opiate overdose. Again, this is back in 2024. And then, and I quote, a Bridge, Michigan investigation revealed that while in Congress from 2001 to 2015, Mike Rogers was a leading advocate for greater access to pain medications, which are typically variations of opiates. He received hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from the same drug companies that are now paying billions of dollars in national opiate settlements for their roles in causing the epidemic. Mike Rogers, the story says, acknowledged in 2006 that drug companies considered him a champion of their industry. Now, you see, to me, that's an extremist position, a beyond extremist position, to take the side of Big Pharma as it was a champion for pushing more and more opiates on Americans. Hey, but don't call Florida Mike Rogers a lobbyist. Yeah, he was their advocate in Congress, and thousands died because of his advocacy. That's what Florida Mike Rogers doesn't want you to know. And that's why he's rushing to silence Dr. Abdul with this little cease and desist threat. Because Dr. Abdul is showing how Florida Mike's true work really hurt Americans while he was in Congress. And then I had to go back and I found this story that I remembered reading and then talking about here on the show many months ago. And it was reported by Michigan Advance's John King from that 2024 campaign. And this is what he said. The 60-year-old Mike Rogers represented mid-Michigan in the U.S. House for 7 terms from 2001 to 2015 and also served as chair of the powerful House Intelligence Committee before retiring from politics, moving to Florida, and becoming a defense lobbyist. But don't call Florida Mike Rogers a lobbyist. I mean, look at this, everyone. Florida Mike Rogers used his longtime DC connections to help make loads of cash as a lobbyist and then also as a senior advisor for some telecommunications companies that were doing business with the U.S. Defense Department. And the revolving door, the Epstein class, right? The revolving door between government and business, business and government, corporate authoritarianism. And then after using his insider status to make millions, Florida Mike Rogers, who voted down affordable prescription drug prices while being part of the opiate crisis, is now trying to tell working class Michiganders that he's their everyman. I mean, he even has some pathetic political ad, or maybe it's a PAC ad. I can't exactly remember. But in that ad, it says that while the nation is definitely hurting, it could be worse with Democrats in control. What a loser. What a freaking loser. And what a pathetic message, where Florida Mike says that he just wants to keep the status quo. Everything is A-OK. Well, we know that he loves the Iran war. We know that he loves ICE. We know that he loves Israel. Now, that's an extremist politician we do not need here in Michigan. And you know what? That's an extremist lobbyist that we do not need here representing us in Michigan. Leftoflansing@gmail.com is the best way to reach me. Subscribe to the show wherever you are listening and also on YouTube. Hey, and subscribe to the show on Patreon. And if you'd like, you can drop off a small donation if you like what you're hearing. You know, every dollar helps us, since unlike MAGA talkers, we don't really get backed by Epstein class interest here on Michigan's premier progressive podcast at all. But still, it is free to sign on Patreon no matter what. I'm not charging anything. I just have a little donation page there up for you if you'd like to do so. Coming up here in a moment, progressive Democratic candidate for Michigan's 1st Congressional District, Kyle Blomquist, will join us to talk about his campaign, which is garnering a lot of attention across the Upper Peninsula and the northern portion of the Lower Peninsula. We'll talk about his race against the so-called pragmatic centrist in this Democratic primary race. A centrist, by the way, who lost to the rubber stamp for Dear Leader Trump and the Epstein class Congressman MAGA Republican Jack Bergman. But for some reason, some state Democrats are saying, yeah, let's run that person again. We'll also talk about housing, why Democratic socialism has got some real momentum in many parts of this country, including in the 1st Congressional District. And also, we'll talk about Kyle's call for a moratorium on data centers. Kyle Blomquist will join me here in a few moments. Okay, before we talk to Kyle, though, I've got to talk about these primary races that happened in New York City this week, in which Democratic Socialist Mayor Zoran Mamdani claimed a big victory as all three of his House Representative endorsements won this week, defeating establishment Democrats in each race. Now, of course, you're hearing many in corporate media circles and the political intelligentsia and, of course, MAG Republican fascist talkers and influencers claim that this proves how far the Democratic Party is turning left. Well, a recent Gallup poll shows that only 42% of Democrats view capitalism favorably, while 66% have a positive view of socialism. And guess what? If you think Dear Leader Trump is practicing in capitalism, then I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you. And of course, several polls show wide support for Medicare for All, abolishing ICE, and ending the never-ending trough of cash that's headed towards Israel's genocidal government. Now, you're hearing how this is just a New York City thing, and that the Democratic Socialist Movement is competing in races where Democrats have a stronghold on certain districts. Well, yeah, I mean, that's how a movement starts. Now, where the Green Party always got it wrong was that it just went for the presidency. I mean, there was no movement, there was no message, no organization. You see, MAGA Republicanism and Donald Trump didn't just happen overnight. It was a slow process, which essentially began in the 1960s with the Barry Goldwater campaign. I mean, you can go all the way back to 1964. That's how long the process has been going on there for MAGA Republicanism. They chose to go local, 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 you know, like city councils, school boards, state legislature seats, state attorneys general seats, and then congressional seats, Senate seats. And then once they had the full infrastructure that was in place, the presidency. See, that's how it all starts. You have to have a movement. And another thing that the corporate authoritarian right-wing movement has always had is an infrastructure, a media infrastructure. And I think you're starting to see that with the Democratic Socialist Movement. They are building a real infrastructure, an infrastructure that is outdueling the Democratic establishment in many ways. So the best place for Democratic Socialists to start is by beating incumbents in safe Democratic districts. Incumbents, you know, let's be honest, everyone, that seem more comfortable losing while they still get to keep their cushy little jobs. As we've been talking about here ever since the 2024 election, the National and State Democratic Party lost its way by catering to corporate interests, all the way to the point that they forgot that representing workers is what the Democratic Party was supposed to be all about. I remember when Hillary Clinton debated Donald Trump in 2016, and he hammered her over she and her husband's support for NAFTA. Trump argued during that debate how NAFTA killed jobs in Michigan and elsewhere, and Hillary's response to those attacks was just a feeble, well, that's your opinion. That's all she had. Because you see, they weren't used to being questioned like that. Hillary Clinton, if I had to remind everyone, lost Michigan in both the primary and the national election that year. And remember, Bernie Sanders, her primary opponent, was also against NAFTA. Fast forward to now, and we see Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer standing side by side with billionaire tech bros for a groundbreaking of a hyperscale AI data center, a data center that received massive tax breaks, by the way, while the people in that township of Saline were against it. What that proved to me is that the corporate Democratic Party elites still aren't getting it and aren't getting why Democratic-based voters have such a low opinion of them. So much so that they're turning to those who are actually taking time to listen to them and who are actually promising to fight the fascistic MAGA Republican movement and who are also promising to fight to strengthen the working class. They just aren't promising to protect certain things. They are promising to strengthen the working class. I mean, that's why we've got Democratic Party incumbents such as Detroit's crypto king, Congressman Sri Thandahar, in a serious race against progressive working class voice Donovan McKinney. And that's why we've got a strong working class pro-Medicare for All, pro-Senate filibuster reform, and pro-abolishing ICE candidate Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed winning right now in that Democratic primary race with very little TV ad support. I mean, the establishment and AIPAC's darling of a pick, Congresswoman Haley Stevens, has so many political action committee ads flooding the TV airwaves. I mean, you'd really think that she was some effective congresswoman who was also endorsed by Obama. Neither, of course, is true, but I'd like you to notice the next time you see one of those pro Haley Stevens PAC ads, they'll all say that she's a fighter who proposed this bill or who sponsored that bill. Okay, so what? Sponsoring a bill is like the easiest thing to do. You just put your name on it. And it's not all that brave to sponsor a bill that has no chance of passing. But when push came to shove, they won't tell you how Haley Stevens voted on a resolution to thank ICE for its service to this country, or how she does not believe in Medicare for all, or how she's all about having corporate PAC money involved in each and every campaign. No, they won't say that. And even more, those ads won't say the name APAC on them. I mean, they'll just go through using front names to hide who they truly are and thereby hide who Haley Stevens truly is. The Democratic Party base, the working class base, though, is onto their game and no longer wants to be part of this game. And the base is calling for a change, vast, immediate working class change. And, you know, I'm also sick of hearing all of these establishment Democrats and talkers cry and complain on how appalled they are by the tone of Democratic Socialists and that they aren't being nice to those who've helped screw over the working class for years and who helped give us Trump twice and then thereby giving us more fascism. They want decorum. Well, guess what, everyone? Decorum goes out the window when fighting for real change. We're about to celebrate the 250th birthday of America, and I hate to tell it to you, I hate to break it to many of you, but those arguing for and who fought for independence didn't really have the time to stick to decorum. We are in the fight for the future of this country and the Democratic Party's existence. This is no time for the tone police. Either step in and join in this fight and take the battle to them, or step aside. Kyle Blomquist is coming up here in just a moment. You're listening to LOL.
A working class voice for the working class. It's Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. If you'd like to tell Pat what you think of the show and maybe even congratulate him for providing podcasting excellence, oh brother, email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. If you have an idea for a guest or a topic for a future show, email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com. We'd like to thank you for listening and for helping spread the progressive message in the Mitten State and beyond. Now, here's Pat Johnston.
Hey, thanks again to all of you who subscribe to the show wherever you are listening. Remember, subscribers and our numbers, subscriber numbers really matter in helping push Michigan's progressive message to as many out there as possible. Remember, the corporate media is not progressive friendly and will do everything in its power to silence or block true working class progressive voices from being part of the entire political dialogue and political discourse. And that goes for both in Michigan and for the entire country. So again, thank you so much for subscribing. All right. Speaking of a strong working class progressive voice, Kyle Blomquist is running to become the Democratic nominee for Michigan's first congressional district, which includes the entire Upper Peninsula, as well as a decent portion of the Northern Lower Peninsula. Now, the people of the 1st Congressional District are currently being so-called represented by MAGA Republican Congressman Louisiana Jack Bergman, who's nothing but a rubber stamp for the Trump regime and especially for the Epstein class. And I also have to note here that Kyle Blomquist also serves on the Iron Mountain City Council as well, as he's just another one of those strong working class voices who actually spends time in his community, volunteers his time in his community, and just tries to make his community a better place to live for everyone. So Kyle Blomquist, thanks so much once again for taking a little time out of your jam-packed schedule to talk with us here on Michigan's Premier Progressive Podcast.
I appreciate you having me out again. I really enjoyed it last time.
I wanted to start out by getting your reaction to, you know, what I thought was a pretty cool endorsement that you earned last week from our good friend and president of Traverse Indivisible, John DeSpelder. John's joined us here on the podcast a few times, and he said that the Traverse Indivisible Steering Committee voted to endorse your campaign, saying, and I'm quoting here, says that at the end of the day, this endorsement is about more than a single campaign. It reflects our belief that the First District is ready for a different kind of politics, one rooted in accountability, participation, and genuine connection to the people who live here. For those reasons, we are proud to endorse Kyle Blomquist for Congress. You know, they've done great work, Kyle, as well, as you know, in that region and engaging voter anxiety and anger ever since 2024. And they've really reversed that anger and anxiety into, you know, building a community and a progressive change that's desperately needed. So how'd that endorsement make you feel? And did that endorsement confirm for you that you're really running the right kind of campaign that Democrats probably should be running throughout the state and elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, I was surprised by that one, and I'm just deeply honored and humbled to earn Traverse Indivisible's endorsement. John Dispelder has been, you know, all the conversations I've had with him, he understands his community, he understands the needs and the moment that we're in. And I think that the endorsement from Traverse Indivisible reflects that as well. I think that a lot of organizations like that are building more resilient communities in the light of Trump 2.0. And I say all the time is the electoral process is slow. It's unreliable, especially with the way that our campaigns are financed these days, the amount of corporate money in there, the amount of dark money in our politics. We need to be able to not only rely on that election process, but we have to be able to work on the ground level through mutual aid, through organizing groups like Indivisible to make sure that our communities are durable against the rising tide of fascism right now. And when I received Traverse Indivisible's endorsement, I was really blown away. And then a few days later, we had an event, a Q&A event at Right Brain Brewery in Traverse City. And, you know, I think we were expecting 75 to 100 people, and we got near 250 people in there. And it was really incredible to see that amount of energy building as we head towards the primary.
You know, Kyle, after the 2024 election, I said on here soon afterwards that before Democrats could really even go about trying to figure out how to defeat Trump and MAGA Republicans, that Democrats would really have to first and foremost figure out what they really are standing for and who they really are. And I'm not really surprised by how well many of these working class, progressive, outsider Democratic candidates are doing across the country since then. Did the 2024 election kind of, I don't know, help you draw similar conclusions? And is that why you ultimately decided to get into the race?
You know, I think that the moment has been here for a while. I think that where we are starting to see the most success might not be the best word for it, but where we're starting to see the most momentum right now is that people are starting to realize that the strategy that we've been sold for decades now, that we need to put the things that are in our best interest, whether that be Medicare for all or sound housing reform or living wages, that we have to put all those things in the back burner so that we can address the need to get elected, as if those things will not get us elected. And what we're finding right now is that that spell is lifted for many people. They're realizing that that was a grift in and of itself, and that what it was really doing was it was meant to arrest our development as a nation. And I think they're rejecting that. I think they're rejecting establishment politics writ large, whether that be on the Democratic Party side or the Republican Party side. And now we have an opportunity to really take this, call it weakened party, and remake it in our own image, make it into something that actually works for working people again, and reject a lot of the conventional knowledge that usually precipitates down from the consulting class.
I'm just wondering, Kyle, are you like being contacted or being heard from others in, let's say, the state Democratic Party at all?
You know, we don't hear too much from them. We will communicate with them to the extent that we need to. There's not what I would consider to be an open adversarial relationship or anything like that, but we're running our race exactly the way that we know a race should be run in this district, as well as other districts like ours throughout the country. We're not relying on anybody for help right now. We're not waiting for the cavalry to arrive and suddenly join our voices here. We so often here in the American working class, we've got us, right? We've got each other. We'll do it all ourselves if we have to.
I know we touched on this the last time you were on, but I wouldn't mind just expanding a little bit. What drew you to democratic socialism? Was it Bernie Sanders from 2016? Or do you look back and say, you know what, I think I may have been going down this path even before then?
You know, I think it was much more gradual than that, I think. You know, I might have mentioned it this last time we spoke, is when I graduated from high school, I was a Republican, like most of my friends and much of my family members at the time. And I think that most people inherit a partisan identity. I was able to kind of break free of that partisan identity, realize that it wasn't doing me any favors. I wasn't eager then to pick up a second partisan label in becoming a Democrat. But really, it was more recognizing that my values were human values. I believe much more in cooperation than I believe in competition. I know what it's like to be able to work within a community collaboratively and make sure that we're all working for the benefit of all of us rather than trying to knock someone down or fight over less and less. I believe that I arrived at, you know, democratic socialism more as a matter of fact than anything dogmatic. I didn't decide I was going to become a democratic socialist and then backfill it with beliefs in the similar way that I did when I inherited a Republican identity, or even the way I did when I was Catholic. I had a Catholic upbringing, but in many people's families, you learn what your religion is first, and then you learn what the beliefs behind that religion are second. Mm-hmm. It's the complete opposite with arriving at democratic socialism, is that the things I wanted to see for my neighbors, the outcomes that I wanted to see both in my own community and around the globe, align with the democratic socialists of America and the general platform. And so it was more recognizing that I was a democratic socialist, perhaps all along, I was just working my way towards that.
And here's the thing now, it just seems like you talk about momentum, about outsiders, you know, getting into the political sphere. It does seem like the democratic socialist message that also has been gaining momentum here for, I'd say, at least for the past decade. And we're seeing it really, I think, pick up since Trump 2.0. I don't know if you're getting the same feeling.
I am. That's for a combination of factors. One, DSA is very well organized. It's a democratic organization. I mean, the membership votes, the membership decides the direction. What that does is that it gives agency to the people within that organization, and it empowers them to be bold within their communities. And I think that when we've seen some recent electoral successes, is the biggest one being Zohran Mamdani, now that has lended a degree of legitimacy that really has been kind of gaslit away from the DSA for a while, I believe, is we are still working through a relatively durable Red Scare that was ingrained mostly in our parents' generation. Mm-hmm. But more and more people are starting to reject capitalism more than anything, is they're starting to recognize that all of the things that make their life difficult are making their lives difficult in our current rapacious capitalist system. And that any alternatives that we use any number of media scare tactics against can't be all that much worse than a system that you pay a private health insurance company to deny your claims and put you in medical debt, or you see so much of your housing stock being commodified and bought up by affluent parties so that you can't even afford to live in the community you work. There's any number of structural abnormalities that are created in this kind of late stage capitalism that is getting more and more people to awaken to the possibilities elsewhere.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I think sometimes a lot of people would use how we're deregulating so much, right? Deregulating in capitalism. But I always thought that it was more re-regulating. It's kind of how I looked at it, what Congress does. And what I mean is that it seems like Congress will reward certain businesses, certain industries, certain corporations, and then that will hurt others. In fact, that ends up being monopolization, and that's not helping anybody in the end.
Absolutely. I think that there's a myth, and everybody recognizes it as a myth, that this market is absolutely free for all parties to succeed or fail, when really the market is increasingly rigged for fewer and fewer parties to succeed. And that is a feedback loop that is actually necessitated by this. And if we throw in the Citizens United decision of 2010, right, and the way that it opened up the floodgates for massive amounts of corporate and special interest money flooding into our elections and putting the thumb on the scale in terms of who actually represents us in Congress and ultimately what they're going to be voting for, whether they're going to be voting for their constituents or some constituent special interest that pumped a bunch of money into their campaign. I think that what we have right now is a heavily engineered system, just like any other heavily engineered system. It's just engineered to be extractive from the American working class, and it's meant exclusively to benefit a handful of billionaires.
When you get into Congress, would you be somebody who would really try to push to reverse Citizens United?
I think that if we could overturn Citizens United with a constitutional amendment or do any number of other things to add incremental transparency and limitations on money in our politics, that would have almost an overnight impact to the not only the elections, but how much it would open the possibilities in terms of what we imagine we can accomplish through our legislation. So much of when you're going even on the campaign trail, everyone will come up to you and say, man, I love everything you have to say, but how are you going to do it? And the how are you going to do it is always referencing either directly or indirectly this inertia that exists in Congress, is that there's this majority of people that regardless of what the population wants, it's the individual members of Congress or a collective body of Congress is not actually activating the will of the people. And so I believe that we shouldn't use that as an excuse not to do better. In fact, we need to do better at a greater rate and more aggressively. And man, if we could ever get Citizens United overturned, I think our politics would correct itself within 2 or 3 election cycles.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree with you there. Your opponent, Kelly Barr, in the Democratic primary here, she ran and lost to MAGA Republican Jack Bergman, of course, a couple of years ago, and is once again here running again to represent, I think, this kind of so-called pragmatic centrism or something like that. I think that's what the Detroit News described her as a couple of days ago as well. Kyle, I was wondering, I've talked about this a bit on the show a lot, actually, I shouldn't say a bit, a lot, when it comes to this whole notion of centrism, because I don't think anybody can really give a real plain definition of what being a centrist really is, because in my mind, I hear centrist, I hear corporatist. What's your reaction, or how would you maybe define centrist?
You know, centrism is, it's implied, you know, centrist or moderate are the terms that are thrown around. And it implies, one, that there's a value associated there. It's meant to say, I don't go extreme in either direction. So it's implied that that's somehow the correct decision, that there's a find this level. Centrism to me, in terms of our politics, the idea that you're going to land somewhere along the kind of the right flank of the Democratic Party or the left flank of the Republican Party, there's so much overlap in the parties as it is. The problem isn't that they're is such a partisan ideological divide between the Republicans and Democrats that we can't get anything done, is that so much of our Democratic Party is captured by the similar forces that MAGA is captured by, so that it ensures that none of the things that we really need to get done, get done. Now, when I look at what centrist policy looks like, is it looks like a slow decline. The idea that we could just arrest things in place or freeze it in amber and safeguard the things that we have right now that don't work, I reject that wholeheartedly. I think that we're either moving forward or moving backwards. Those are the two options. And if we deserve healthcare as a human right, as a guarantee, if you are offering anything short of that, you are trying to promote that as if you are pushing the cart forward, but at a slower rate. But I see it more as you are trying to stop that cart, or you are the brakes, not just a slow acceleration. I think that we need to start looking at people within that cohort, people, especially those that fail to or avoid articulating a position on any number of things that are salient in our lives. I think in our district, I think about a handful of things. I think about data centers. I think about the Line 5 pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac and along the US 2 corridor across the Upper Peninsula. If you're a candidate in this race right now, or you've been a candidate in this race for 3 years, and you can't articulate a position on data centers and Line 5, I think that that tells you a lot, honestly. The lack of an answer tells you plenty. And I think the same thing when I see somebody who fails to take a public position on Gaza, is if you can't take a public position on a transparently broadcast live stream genocide that's perpetrated with our tax dollars in violation of existing U.S. law and existing international law, if you can't take a very solid, sound, coherent position against that, then you are complicit in it. And so I think that centrism is too often sold as pragmatism, when really I see it as conservatism.
That is a great point, because that's always been my argument. It seems like centrism sort of is like capitulation, and then it just leads us further and further and further to the right on the political spectrum. You mentioned data centers. What is your stance when it comes to data centers?
Right now, we have the floodgates absolutely open, and those floodgates were pried open further by the state legislature and the Whitmer administration in passing these tax breaks for these AI data centers. And I believe that we need to have a moratorium on data center construction. Right now, you know, we're always sold as if this is an arms race that we have with China. Well, if it's an arms race with China that we have over AI, then we won that arms race a while ago, because we have 12 times the number of data centers as China has. 12 times. And we're still building them at an increasing lack of care for the communities in which they're locating. And Saline Township's a perfect example of that. What the example that was set for Saline Township should terrify everybody, whether you are Republican, Democrat, independent, or otherwise. If you don't want data centers in your community, you want to be able to have say in that process. And being illustrated very plainly that what happened in Saline Township is the community said no, the planning commission said no, township board said no, the data center company said yes through money and lawfare, and they ended up getting their way. And so I think it's kind of disgraceful to see Governor Whitmer posing alongside Sam Altman starting to dig that hole there in Saline Township, because there are few better examples of the rapacious instinct of capitalism to override the will of the people, to force their will upon our resources. And so I think that we need to slam on the brakes when it comes to data center construction. We're going to be having a rally coming this Saturday in Sault Ste. Marie, where we're going to have a rally against the machine. It's going to be an anti-data center rally. We're going to be informing our neighbors, and we're going to be reaching across the aisle to people who agree with us, who tend to vote conservative or vote Republican in Northern Michigan, to show them that there is somebody who actually wants to listen to them. Because tell you what, we talked about centerism. Tendency is with the Democratic Party these days is that they try to strike this balance between business forces and worker forces. And one, I think that those are difficult to reconcile as it is, but it's also a deeply imbalanced situation that there is no equality between the power of a billion-dollar company and a handful of residents of a township or a county here or there. And so where there's going to be 500 some odd lawmakers who are always going to defer to business interests or trying to have the distance between what the people want and what business wants, I'll be one of the few who will just stand with the people. And if somebody thinks that that is me being a Luddite or being against technology, or they think that that is an anti-business stance, it is a pro-worker stance first. And if the businesses want to get in line and function in a way that benefits the American working class, then we'll be friends all day long. If they won't, then they will have an adversary in me in Congress.
Awesome. That's just one reason why your campaign is catching fire. So a couple of episodes ago, I had the pleasure to talk with Dr. Jeffrey Insko of The Current. It's a great blog that he writes on Line 5. I know it's a major, major topic up there. I believe your stance, Kyle, is that you want it closed. What do you hear from constituents up there when you say, when you express your desire to have Line 5 ultimately closed?
What I hear from people who are thinking of it in terms of electoral consequences first, they'll tell me, you need to be quiet about Line 5, or you need to take a more vague position on Line 5 because you're gonna shed voters, because the people in the Upper Peninsula, they rely on it. They'll be upset. Tell you what, you talk to anybody that I've met in real life, and they do not need Line 5. They do not support Line 5. There are the labor unions, which I understand that they have an interest in those projects moving forward, but I would rather employ good union labor to decommission Line 5, to remove it from Straits of Mackinac, remove it from the US 2 corridor, and be able to realize our power and our rights, honestly, in terms of what state and federal law dictates in terms of our ability to have a say in that process. It's been wrapped up in the courts. And so for me, it's just one of a million examples of we use the excuse of a bureaucratic process as a reason why the people's will not be activated. We need to start to act more aggressively to empower communities, especially our native peoples, and defer to them, because they should have ultimate sovereignty and ultimate say over the conservation of our natural resources.
I know that affordable housing is one of your major planks that you're running on during this campaign. And I know, Kyle, you're running for Congress, which will put you in Washington, D.C., and talking about everything on the federal level. But what I'm just going to ask you real fast, since I've got you and you know your stuff when it comes to housing, I'd like to ask you something that's more on a state issue. And it's this movement in the Republican State House to cut property taxes. And they believe that that's really going to help working class families. That's really going to help lower the costs of housing here in the state. I was just wondering, since, you know, you, again, spend a lot of time talking about affordable housing, what's your take on the idea of cutting property taxes?
I think the idea that we need to cut taxes, regardless of what those taxes go to fund, is always a bizarre instinct. That it seems really strange to be able to cut off your revenue stream without then having some kind of solution. And what it's going to end up doing is it's going to end up being another live grenade that's going to be thrown at counties and municipalities. It's going to be another live grenade that's going to throw the state budget in disarray. It's crazy to think that we are going to remove property taxes and that that is somehow going to have some transformative impact on the general of affordability of housing, let alone whatever the knock-on effects or the collateral effects of that would be on society up and down. I mean, I'm on Iron Mountain City Council. I don't know what the hell we would do if we didn't have property taxes. I know there's any number of different proposals, but I think the last thing that anybody really wants is to start to pull at that thread without any kind of solution in place. And that's what I see. That's what I see. This is nothing more than the typical Republican state house. It's posturing. They know that they're never going to do it. And I think that it's so disingenuous to look at it from a housing affordability perspective. The reason why our housing is unaffordable is because we commodified it, because so much of it is captured not by people who are owner occupants, who are building household wealth through their mortgage and the building of equity in a piece of real property. It is that people who have excess money are able to buy multiple homes in oftentimes those starter homes that the young families or the people on a fixed income rely on. And instead, they're flipping them and making them Airbnbs. It's because we have funneled all of our public spending toward on housing towards these public-private partnerships that interject and infuse that process with profit and bureaucratic burden, and then hope that there's scale and affordability out the back end of it. There are probably a dozen and a half things that contribute to the rising cost of housing that have absolutely nothing to do with your property taxes. And here in the state of Michigan, your property taxes rise at CPI or 5%, whichever is the lower of the two. And so there's actually a cap on how much our housing or our property values when it comes to our property taxes can actually inflate. So everything else around that process is inflating at much higher rate than your property taxes ever have.
That gives even more insight. And again, I think this is just another failure of capitalism that we're seeing with these rising housing prices, as you just explained. Kyle, one last question. You mentioned how you're on the Iron Mountain City Council. Have you ever met Jack Bergman?
No, I've never met Jack Bergman.
Really? Oh, I'm surprised. No. I am a little bit surprised. I don't know why.
Oh, you think he's going municipality and saying hello to all the county and city boards? Well,
I hear he loves people. I hear he's a people person.
Oh, good. Maybe he's like a people watcher. Maybe he was incognito. But no, Jack Bergman, there are worse things about Jack Bergman than his absence. I'll say this. Some of my Democratic opponents would like to focus on Jack Bergman's absence rather than focusing on the fact that Jack Bergman, by building up this process that is deeply extractive and is deeply cruel, whether that be our carceral system or our healthcare system or our housing failures or our war apparatus. And so Jack Bergman has a hell of a lot of things to answer for in his voting practices, in the way that he wields power on our behalf, that is completely divorced from the fact that he is a carpetbagger from Louisiana.
And I think that's probably why you believe that you will be the best candidate to take him on, because you're going to give the voters a real stark choice than if we just continue going down the same road that Democrats have gone down in the first district here for many years. Kyle, thanks again for being on. If people would like to learn more about your campaign, how can they do so?
Oh, yes. Please go to BlomquistForCongress.com. There you'll be able to find our social media handles. You'll be able to follow us, get our daily updates. You could sign up to volunteer for our campaign. We have canvases right now every week. We're moving it towards being canvassing every single day within the district. It's a massive district. Whether you're able to volunteer in one of our canvassing operations or you're willing to phone bank, that helps us cover a massive district. We're 44% of Michigan. We've got 7% of the population, just like all the other reps, but we have much more distance to cover, you know, in many cases, much less resources to do it with. In terms of resources, if you're willing to throw us a donation, it would mean a lot. It is a lot of ground to cover, and gas keeps oscillating between $4 and $5. So it's every little bit counts. That's the best way to get us is BlomquistForCongress.com.
And I'll share all of those links wherever people are listening. Kyle Blomquist, Michigan's first congressional district Democratic candidate. Thanks again for being on, and I wish you lots of luck and lots of success, my friend.
Thanks a lot. It was great talking to you.
Bringing progressivism with passion each and every week. It's Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. Follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, and the Gram. Subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. And subscribe to us on YouTube. We'd also like to thank Audioboom for publishing the show and helping us spread our populist, progressive, and patriotic message. Speaking of which, let's get back to the show with Pat.
A special thanks again to Kyle Blomquist for visiting us here again. And I'm with Kyle on his stances for shutting down Line 5, in which I'd also say that the Canadian energy company that owns Line 5, that being Enbridge, has always argued, you know, how closing it down will lead to higher prices. Well, we see how it can't be anywhere close to as high as Dear Leader and Israel's war in Iran have done it, right? So that argument goes out the window. And I also agree with his call for a moratorium on data centers. But even more, Kyle would just bring a consistent, much-needed, working-class-first and an American-first voice to a Congress that has been way too busy sticking up for the Epstein class. I'll provide links to his campaign site and also to his social media sites wherever you are listening. All right, last week's LOL weekly poll showed that a majority of you are like me in saying data rather than data. It was all about data centers and data centers, whatever. And I think I say data primarily. I hate to dork out here, but I think it's because of Mr. Data from Star Trek The Next Generation. So I always say data. It's always been data for me. Anyway, thanks again for all your votes. This week's LOL poll is the following. Which one do you view more favorably? Capitalism or socialism? Vote on either the Left of Lansing Patreon page or our Twitter page or on the YouTube page. Time now for the Left of Lansing last call. In a recent study published by Nature, MAGA Republicans are dying at much higher rates than those on the left side of the political spectrum. Now, this study chose to put political ideology on the list of variables for the very first time, and the authors say that they really couldn't find a death rate gap between the two ideologies until after 2010. It was slowly happening. But by 2020, they had pretty clear evidence of a gap in which conservatives are less healthy than liberals, said one of the study's co-authors. Now, the authors say that their findings also show that the divide or gap widened, especially from 2020 to 2022, as right-wingers' distrust in doctors and the entire medical system widened. That distrust accelerated, of course, during the pandemic as people fought over vaccines and about even wearing masks, which, for me, that's where I knew that we had lost it as a country mentally, that we went bye-bye, that we just simply didn't care about other people. I mean, doctors wear masks in surgery to guard against infecting the patient. Suddenly, I was being told that those doctors were idiots for following long-held scientific tradition and scientific fact. And for the record, I still appreciate seeing some people wearing masks at stores or on airplanes if they're sick. I think that is a kind thing to do. It's caring about your fellow man. I wore a mask when flying back from Europe last year when I had a double ear infection. I was on a plane for 8 hours. I didn't want others getting whatever I had. I guess I just have this moronic thing that I do, which is show compassion for others. But I digress. Even worse, though, as the pandemic gets further and further into the rear view, one consequential byproduct is that more and more of conservatives have become distrustful of their health professionals, and so they won't go and get their blood pressure taken, or they won't see anybody for chest pains. That's according to the study. This mistrust is amplified with Robert Kennedy Jr. taking control of the health department, where he's pushing his fact-free, pro-idiotic, anti-vaccination agenda on the entire American people. And with measles rising, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention plans to end federal diagnostic testing for measles and mumps, the agency confirmed to Politico on Monday. Hey, isn't that just terrific? Brilliant! And now NBC News reports that more than 5 million working-class Americans did not enroll in Obamacare, as Dear Leader Trump's and the MAGA Republicans' Big Beautiful Bill, otherwise known here as the MAGA Murder Budget, refused to reinstate Obamacare subsidies, which is why we need Medicare for All. So people are getting sicker, but the means of getting health care is growing harder and harder. As Michigan Progressive State Representative Kerry Reingan said on social media this week, MAGA's misinformation is literally killing their own voters. Hey, but I'm told that's the moderate position.
You're listening to Left of Lansing. Music for the show and everything else on Left of Lansing is provided by Wanderbeats. To hear the latest project and complete music archives, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site or subscribe to Space Leopard on YouTube. Now, back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Special thanks again to Kyle Blomquist for being on the show again. You know, I remember when I was on WSGW radio in Saginaw and one of my co-hosts called me a socialist on the air, thinking, you know, that I would reject that label quickly. I didn't. I did say, you know, you can call me a democratic socialist, you know, which helped give us Social Security, banking regulations, and Medicare. And that was about 15 years ago. I wasn't sure if America would join me in celebrating that label, but you know what? It's happening at a far faster pace than I even dreamed would happen. However, it's not that difficult to understand considering how capitalism is failing the working class, spurred on by government intervention to help those most powerful of industries like the tech bros who are just part of the Epstein class. So no, this is not a surprise to me that democratic socialism is becoming more and more popular with the working class. Next week, progressive state representative and working class fighter Betsy Cafia of Traverse City is back on the show for the first time this year. And you know what? I know we will have lots to talk about, so I'm looking forward to it. And I also have to say this. I wondered if I would ever have to install the big air conditioning unit for the living and dining rooms this year. I really was questioning it, but alas, it looks like I will this weekend as 90-degree weather with high humidity is arriving next week. Ugh. Yeah, you will have to hear me complain about it a little. I know. Many of you are going to celebrate that. I will admit, I want summer to finally arrive here, too. I really wasn't digging having, like, you know, October weather in mid-June. So, summer, give us what you've got. Until next time, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
You've been listening to Left of Lansing with Pat Johnston. Left of Lansing was produced by Pat Johnston, brainstormed by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and yes, hosted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. Thanks to our good friend Rich for website assistance, and thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. We thank Audio Boom for publishing the podcast every week. Visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to Michigan's premier progressive podcast, and we'll talk with you again next week.